He kōna ipurangi tēnei nā te reo irirangi o Aotearoa.
This episode contains discussion of the loss of a child. Please take care when listening.
Oh my God, there's this friend of mine at line dancing every time. She says, hey Jean, like, what have you been up to? And I swear, it's just like...
brain fart.
It's like this. Every time, I actually just pause. I can't even think. I'm like...
online.
And I'm like thinking, I'm like... and I'm like, shit, I don't know. Like, she, it happens every time. Like, it doesn't change. Like, I have to, it's almost like on my way to town, I'll be like, okay, what did I do yesterday? So when I'm asked this question, I'm ready for the answer.
Taking notes on your own life. Yeah, yeah, I do the same.
To meet Jenny, who you just heard from then, photographer Fran and I flew into Gisborne and then drove inland for an hour towards the small settlement of Matawai. Jenny Sanford, in her late 30s, lives on a sheep and beef farm just outside Matawai, which she farms with husband Ant. We're here for the day, but I feel like we'll only scratch the surface of how crazy, beautiful, and wild her life is. As a self-diagnosed ADHDer, Jenny's life is a whirlwind. From a beauty school dropout to wild times in Canada, from being a cop to becoming a sheep and beef farmer, from the immense grief of miscarriage, to the joy of line dancing in the woolshed, Jenny takes on whatever comes her way and somehow finds a silver lining. Kia ora, I'm Āpage Taratorangikura, he uri no Ngāti Raukaua, Ngāti Rangi, Ngā Puhi me Ngāti Rārua. This is Far From Town, made by Shepherdess in RNZ, stories of women at the end of windy gravel roads and up remote valleys across Aotearoa.
Oh,
do you know?
Yeah, this is last year's lamb.
Oh my
this
goodness.
This is jumpsuit popcorn, named by the children.
Pet?
Jumpsuit popcorn.
While their kids, 7-year-old Darcy, 5-year-old Ada, and 3-year-old Grace, introduce us to all of their family pets and play, we have a cuppa with Jenny and Ants and listen to two very different takes on how they met.
Canada.
Yeah, but he already, you thought I was a snob. Hey, so when we first met each other...
No, you wouldn't, I used to try and talk to you, but you wouldn't talk to me.
No, because I was so, this is how it goes. He went to Smedley with my ex-boyfriend. I remember him, because I remember his hair, eh? he would like to sort of, like, thing his hair up, it was terrible. So we kind of we knew who each other was, but I guess when I was in that group, it was like 20 boys, and I was kind of shy, which I guess came across snobby, and you know, and then he was travelling in Canada with my cousin and one of my good guy mates from school and two of my girlfriends. I had gone over later than them because I'd been to Canada before to join up with them, and so he was in that same group, but it wasn't like a hit off, was it? Do you like me in my cowboy boots? Like, we met at the Stampede, or like, we were sort of, yeah, so we were like friends in the same group, but we weren't really like straight into each other. So we were travelling in the same group, and we're all at the Calgary Stampede, which is the biggest like rodeo in the world. And there's this tent called Nashville North, which is where everyone sort of goes to get in the piss. And bearing in mind, we were 20, 21?
24, I think we were.
I don't think, well, were we? Yeah, probably. Okay, so we're older than I thought. And we'd had a little bit to drink, and we had ended up, God knows how, in one of the famous singer's powder room. And did we sort of hook up in there?
I can't remember about it.
I think we'd had quite a lot to drink. I'm not going to say what you were doing in there. And then, no, we hadn't hooked up, and then we got dragged out by the security and kicked out of the Stampede, and then we hooked up that night. We were really drunk. Yeah, we're definitely not perfect, but I think I'm lucky that I've got Ants. He's so calm and he's so forgiving. Like, I would definitely be the fire and the hothead, and he's not. So I think we're like suited because we are quite opposites, and that is what works for us. And I guess also though, is he will see through my fire and my fury. Like, he knows that it'll be there and then it'll be gone. And then he'll just make a joke out of it. Do you know, that's another thing. We bring lots of humour into our relationship. Like, I'll be ridiculous, and it, probably at the time, I know I'm being ridiculous, and whatever it is I'm being ridiculous about. And then he just sort of waits it out, and then, like, that night or the next day, he'll act back to me how I was, and we'll both just laugh, because it's so ridiculous.
Where's my cup of tea?
Can you try again with, where's my cup of tea, please, Dad?
Can I please have a cup of tea, please?
Good one.
Ginny and Ants have a way about them, a very affectionate energy and a real adoration for each other's quirks, which I can relate to, but more about that later. They've been on Ginny's family farm for a few years now, but before farming, she wasn't quite sure of her path.
So first of all, I finished school and I still didn't know what I wanted to do, so I was a bit stuck. And my form teacher at the time said, there's this agricultural exchange, you can go to Canada and, you know, work on farms. So I did that. As soon as I left school, I went to Canada for 7 months and I worked on like a sheep farm and horticulture at farmers markets. So I did sort of all sorts of things there. And then I came back and then I still didn't know what I wanted to do. So I sort of felt a bit of pressure, I guess, society, whatever. And I just picked beautician. So then I went to EIT in Napier and I studied beautician. And then it was the second day in the classroom and she was talking about, you know, would you like your customers like their nails like square or oval, or would they like them squoval? And it was like square and oval mixed together. And I was just like sitting there looking and they looked up and I was like, it was inside. And I was like, this is always going to be inside. And I'm such a outside person. I need fresh air. I need space. And I was like, this just isn't for me. So I quit that and we laughed like Greece, like beauty school dropout. And then I started a job and I went picking fruit. I was like, I just need money. I need cash. I need to pay my rent. So I picked fruit with gangs. Then this job came up in Hastings as like working in a cafe. And while I was doing that, I think I went, there was a recruitment night. I don't know if it was on the radio or in the newspaper. There was a recruitment night for police in Napier. And I was like, I'm just going to go and I'm going to see what I need to start getting. I'm not going to necessarily do this. I need 20 at the time. I'm going to see what I need to start getting in order to be a police officer. Like, what physical things do I need? Is there anything that I need to be sort of like studying? I had no idea. And I went along and the recruitment officer at the time, Rod, forget his last name, he was pretty much like, right, if you want to join, you can join now if you go to police college. And I was like, what? Like, I'm not ready for this. I want to travel. I want to do these things. So I was like, I'm going to think about it. So I went back home and I was like, oh, I'm just going to go. I just had this itch. I was like, do I go to Australia and just working over there for a while or do I go into it? And so I rang him up and I was like, I don't know whether I need to go get a bit more life experience or if I start. And it was like, he goes, well, from our point of view, you start. But from your point of view, probably go and get some, do what you feel you need to do.
After 7 months in Brisbane, Jenny came back to Aotearoa and signed up as a cop. She was just 20. When she graduated 5 months later, she was stationed at Napier as the first young recruit in 5 years. But she had a good section and the guys there really looked after her.
So I knew joining as a young little female that was going to be hard, but I kind of had this attitude that this is what I want to do and I'm just going to work hard at it and I'm just going to prove that I can do this. So you go to police college for 5 months and it was 5 months then, I think it's shorter now, and they do all your training, your firearms, your driver's license, everything. You do like quite a bit of theory because you need to understand certain technical terms that go into what a crime is, so you can differentiate burglary from robbery. There's technical things in there. And then you're just out the door and into the world of being a police officer with a uniform and everyone coming up to you in an emergency thinking that you know what you're doing, and quite often you don't, because every situation is completely different. How could you ever train for every situation that humans get themselves into? But it was just a bit of case of fake it till you make it, really, and that's definitely what I did. I just had to stay calm and be methodical, and yeah, that's what I did. And I remember my first domestic, and I remember the victim, and I remember we got all the way to court, and her husband had, like, her partner at the time had assaulted her, and like I just stuck with her, and I remember her and her friend giving evidence in court, and they stuck with me the entire time, and the like he ended up getting convicted. But I always remember feeling so proud because I put so much work into her and like staying with them and really like helping her. And I remember like at the time the defendant trying to lie in court and them saying, no, that's what not happened, like so straight up. And I was so proud of them, and I just felt like that's what I wanted to do, like make a difference, like that those people, that those victims could have faith in me, that I was going to be with them there to the end. Yeah, that is definitely like a proud moment, and definitely why I joined was to, I just wanted to help people. I just wanted, yeah, one, I was addicted to the adrenaline of the job, but two, I just wanted to help people. That was why I joined.
1, 2, 3, 4, and hands in here, helps you move your hips easier. And we're all wanting to, like, sway around, no one's watching, just us.
By now, you've probably realised that Jenny loves a pivot and is the kind of person who is always giving things a go, including line dancing. It was a hobby she wasn't expecting to enjoy, but now most weeks you'll find her teaching line dancing through a local group, Matawai Boot Sisters. Women from neighbouring farms turn up at Jenny's to dance, the wool shed is all set up for it, fairy lights and all.
2, 3, 4, nothing yet, ready for the music.
So it started with Janine, who was, she is part of Rhythm and Lines, which is the Gisborne Line Dancing Club, and she was coming up to Matawai, which is the community that I live in, and we have a hall in Matawai, and so she was coming up, I can't remember if it was once every 2 weeks or once a month, she was coming up to teach line dancing in Matawai. And so there was a group chat within some of the women in the community that go walking together exercise, I can't remember what.
Can I teach line dancing in the hall?
That was Janine. Hang on, Bubby. And then so they said in the group chat, they were talking about line dancing, and I was like, oh, I said to Ants, I don't know if I really want to, like, sort of go line dancing, like, heel toe, and, I don't think it's really going to be for me. And one of the other women in the chat put, I don't think it's my cup of tea, but I'm going to go up to support something, an initiative that's coming to the community. And I was like, oh, well, put like that, I'll head up there too then, it's lovely that someone's making the effort to come out to Gisborne to bring this thing to our community. Not everyone does that. So I'll head up. And then I headed up for one session and day dot, I was hooked. I think what the line dancing I had in my head was probably a little bit more old school. And that's not to take away from line dancing and what it was back then and what it still is. A lot of clubs still do more traditional line dancing. But I found the music was more modern country, also not always country. There were ways you can move your body which were like hip bumps or more like sassy or sultry if you want them to be. And I love to move my body in that way. It has that added benefits. So dancing's got so many benefits, community, connection, like laughter, the good music, moving your body, exercise, all of those things are ticks for good endorphin, which makes you feel good. Line dancing has the added benefit of synchronicity. So when you're doing something with the person right beside you and all around you, you just have this like sense of like team, and it just gives you this another big high. And also if you sort of lose your place, you look at someone in front of you, behind you, and you like you're straight back in line. So it took me back to like my teenage and my 20s when you go to the pub and you like are getting all those dopamine hits when you're out dancing in the pub or whatever. But this was like we were talking about earlier, during the day I could get like my fix of a fun good time without needing like alcohol or being up late. I could have a bit of a boogie, I could form those connections and get fancy, get off the farm and get a bit fancy, and I could just come home to my like family, and it's perfect really.
I forgot to say things even though we talked so much. How healing it has been for my body after everything, it's made me, oh God, we're all doing it today. trust my body again, and that's the part that I forgot to talk about after a loss and like not enjoying my body to like trusting my body again.
For Jenny, line dancing goes a little deeper than a good time and some exercise. It's the dopamine hit that has been a core part of helping her move through grief. Nine years ago, when they were living at Te Karaka, Jenny and Ant lost their first daughter, Nina, at 20 weeks into the pregnancy.
We're going to see Poppy and Nina.
The cemetery, where Nina is buried, is only a 10-minute quad bike ride across the farm.
How often do you come down to the cemetery?
Not as much as I would like or thought that I would.
Yes.
So, but I always, because I guess I've got to a place in my grief, or in my being a mother to Nina, that I know that it doesn't matter whether I go there or not, because she's not really there, she's like in my heart and she's everywhere, and yeah, I don't have to be there for my love to be there for her, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
And also I knew that, I just knew
when I was viewing her that I was going to have more kids.
Yeah.
And I knew, like, Ants and I were with her a couple of days after you were. We would go there all the time, like, every single night.
Yeah.
And I just, in my head, I was like, this is unsustainable. When I have more kids, I'm not going to be able to get here as much as I would like. And that's a thought that I had, like, soon after we buried her. And it's obviously come to fruition. You know, like, we have more kids now and we just can't get there like we would like to, but we drive past and we have a wave. You know, I had no idea that it was actually just like the loss of a child. It's not the loss of a pregnancy, it's the loss of a child.
Yeah.
And you can only know that until you've gone through that or until you've had children yourself.
Yes.
So before that, I just had no idea. So it was just, obviously, it is the most horrible thing, because I think to love a child is the highest form of love. So to lose a child, to me, is, you know, it's the worst thing that I think could happen to someone. I would rather die than her die. But so I was very vocal, and I would post things and I would share, and that to me was, is the word cathartic? So hearing other people's loss or hearing about how they understood or mothers reaching out was healing to me.
Yeah.
And then that got to a point where it wasn't, I felt like I then kind of owned my grief. Like, to me, it wasn't about how other people viewed Nina, it was my connection with her. That's my son on his microphone. So, and then I went really inward. It wasn't like, initially I needed that because I needed to hear it. I needed the healing. I needed people to know that it really hurts. But now I know that, like, that's kind of mine, not to carry, but that she is special to me. Like, yeah, you get to a point, I don't need it from other people. Like, it's kind of hard to explain, but yeah.
No, I get it.
And even sometimes now for self-preservation, it sounds horrible, but sometimes I try even not to think about it, because it can just bring so much hurt, and it could really just almost be the end of me if I let myself, like, oh, it's getting me, but, like, think about her all the time. It's just something that would never go away. So I did, like, hypnotherapy. Like, I've tried lots of things to heal and to help myself. Like, I've done so much, but two things that really struck me, one thing I did was called the lightning process, and another one I did was like hypnotherapy. But it was like, every time that you're imagining what happened, which is what I would do, your body, it's not just that you're imagining or thinking about it, your body is reliving it every time. So your whole body is having that experience. So that really hit home for me, and I was like, I have to stop doing this to myself. Like, I have to, yeah, I have to not do this to myself anymore. So I guess, yeah, it's your grief is ever changing. You just have to roll with it. And so now I don't think about Nina. I'm just at a place where I know that she will always be a part of me. And certainly I love now that science proves that. Like, when you're pregnant with someone, you know, their DNA mixes with your DNA. So I always knew as soon as I had it, I was like, I am changed forever. But I could never explain why that was. I just knew that I was changed forever. But I love how science proves that you are actually, like, physically changed forever. I knew I was spiritually changed forever and mentally changed forever, but, like, physically changed forever. And that kind of secures that connection that I'll always have with her, that will never be taken away. Yeah, so I guess that's the place where I am in with it at the minute.
I've witnessed this grief personally. 5 years ago, my niece, my younger sister's baby, Noah Lee, passed away at 9 weeks old, which was the most traumatic experience for our whānau. Jenny knows this pain too. She supported her younger sister Ellie when Ellie's baby Poppy died.
And when we found out about it, and I walked into the hospital, and I saw her sitting there, and I looked at her eyes, I just knew that she was going to be going through it. I had it, and that just, like, tore me apart, because I knew that that's what she would be going through. And even, like, a little bit selfishly, I was like, I'm going to be going through it again too, because it's, you know, like, just watching her and knowing that it will bring up things that I've been through too. But then also, you know, a little bit of the silver lining, just knowing, kind of nice too, knowing that I could really understand what it was like. I know when we buried Poppy here, it's such a vivid memory of me. Ellie was, like, kneeling down with her, and she looked at me and she said, I don't know how you did this. And it's just, like, it just stuck out at me so much. I remember her, and I was like, I don't know, I just, well, I had to, but it made her, us all, feel a little bit better that they are here together. So, yeah.
That is, I can understand why you would have chosen to lay Nina to rest here.
Yeah, it's like the perfect place. Like when she was buried here, Dad made sure that there were like sheep all up there in the paddock, you know, behind, and that was just special in itself to me that he'd put all the sheep up there. But yeah, I've got so many photos of her with the hill in the background, you know, that it just, well, not of her, of her headstone, but you know, of us together, and just like just knowing that she's here with that, you know, mountain behind her. I need to go to the toilet. Yep. Yeah, it feels so nice.
As children can often do, we are quickly snapped into a different reality, and at Ada's urgent request, we head back to the house. Jenny's grandfather lived and worked on this hill country farm, as did her father, Dave, with her mum, Trudy. Now, Jenny and Ants run the farm. Though Ants was studying for a helicopter pilot's license, he gave up the sky when Dave needed a hand on the farm.
Well, we've kind of been here for 10 years now. Well, not quite that, it must be 9. It was not long after Nina passed away. That was almost like the catalyst for us to come back here. It was like, that was kind of what did it really. She was buried here, and that when something like that happens, as you probably know, you really like re-look at what your values are, and it was sort of kind of timed in with the time that Mum and Dad are getting sick of it, so it just like kind of happened organically. Then we came back here, we were closer to her, and that was just really healing for us, and then we were able to spend more time together as a family with our aunts always flying during the helicopter thing.
It was kind of quite a quick transition. Like it wasn't it probably wasn't the best way to do it.
No,
because like you were pregnant with Darcy, eh?
Yeah.
Because we swapped houses, so Jen's parents went down to Tikaraka where we were, and we came up here. So it was like it was quite rushed. Yeah. I remember packing up stuff here with Dave, and Trudy wasn't here, and everything was just getting chucked into like black rubbish bags, and it was the whole house was just like nothing was labelled, like no one knew where anything was, and looking back, like, it was pretty bad.
Yeah.
Dave just wanted to get the job done. He's like, we want to get this stuff from here down to there.
I think they were away. Did they go to Australia? It was just Mum in Australia.
She might visiting have been, Dan? Yeah.
She might have been visiting my brother.
It was like one day they were here, and then the next day they were
And I think Dad was like, well, while we're gone, why don't you just move? So Mum went away and came back, and she wasn't here anymore. So, I mean, I guess it was a little bit like ripping the Band-Aid off as well. It was strange, and I was pregnant, and obviously there were, yeah, it was, you know, we were anxious because of Darcy. And
I think it was harder for them than what it was for us.
Yeah.
Because I was running the farm.
He'd already had that transition of working here, whereas Dad probably hadn't had the transition away. He was here one day, and then the next he wasn't.
Because Dave, he was born here, you know, like he'd spent his whole life here.
Yeah.
And then after, he must have been, what, like 60?
Yeah.
Just to... And one day pack up and chuck everything in black rubbish bags and move down to Tikaraka.
That's pretty bold, eh? Especially at like an older age to just be like, yeah, we're just chucking everything in and going.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think like probably physically he was getting ready for the change, you know, like Ants had been doing more and more and he was probably getting sick of it. But then the reality of that, he wouldn't have known how that was going to feel until that happened. And we always understood that, like how hard that would have been for them and for him.
Mm.
It's better now. And it was like a transition. He used to work here like a lot and still come up a lot, and then slowly that's tapered off. I think that's important to have that transition. And, you know, he still comes whenever he wants to or whenever we need him, which he probably doesn't like, eh? Docking and scanning and everything gets the call up. So he's here for all of that, eh? But it's nice, and it's so... The best thing about it all is watching them with the kids, because both of my sets of grandparents are so important in my life. And they just love my parents and Ants's parents. And so being able to see them together all the time, that's the thing that brings us all the most joy. Yeah, for sure. I guess it's just like our turn, you know, because, you know, our grandparents lived here and then Mum and Dad lived here and now it's ours, and... Will our kids or one of our kids come back here? I don't know. It's like we talked about earlier. As long as they're doing what makes them happy, that is the main thing. But I just think it's just important to just do our best for this place. Do you know? Like, whatever happens, We're probably just the size, like the size of our farm, which is probably quite small and just one of the smallest, but just on the verge of like needing another worker, but not, we're not like, we don't have that scale where, you know, a neighbouring farm would have the same expenses as us, but have more scale to have more profitability, but we still need to have the tractor, all the things, but we, yes, we just can't stretch for that extra worker.
Yeah, like the drawings are still the same on a 200 hectare place is what it is on a 600 hectare place, you know.
How many hectares?
Give or take some animal health stuff. What's that?
How many hectares is your farm?
Ours is 400. I look at him and laugh because I ADHD in numbers. I'm like, remember, how big's our farm again? How old's my grandma? Like, what's the, like, how old am I?
Yeah.
You know,
whose birthday was, yeah, last month? What's the date of our children's birthday?
Yeah. Like, all of the things, eh? Yeah. Like, it's like, because I keep on thinking, why do I not remember this? It's so important, but I just can't.
This brings me to something else that Jenny and I share, our neurospicy style of thinking and talking. Come with me on a bit of a side quest.
And then
I call it ping pong. It's like,
yeah,
verbal ping pong. You just,
yeah, because the next one you're like, oh yeah, like,
yeah,
oh yeah.
It's really nice, I think, though.
Yeah.
Like I, yeah, with, like you say, with my other friends, it's so lovely, and it's like,
yeah,
you know, all the things. But then when it's with somebody whose brain is similar to yours, there's just a difference, and
they go into another league.
You go into another, and you can just kind of be your sort of verbal diarrhea self.
Yeah.
Sort of unfiltered brain tangent.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it's so random sometimes. Yeah. Like sometimes there was someone asking me a question. Who was it? Someone did it just to me the other day. Oh, Chantal. So one of my friends, and she's sort of more like quieter in nature. So then sometimes I'll then fill that space more, you know, like in the wrong way, because it's like quiet, so I'll talk more. But then she'll ask me one thing, and then it'll just be like, and she calls it to me, she's like, side quest, eh? Like, she knows,
yes,
what I'm like. She
oh
goes
my
to me,
gosh,
yeah, she goes, side quest, like, but she likes it. She's like, I know how your brain works. Or another friend of mine that's just new but younger, Drew, she goes, I just love your brain, and it makes me feel so nice, you know.
It's
like,
nice to be around people who get it or see it. We use the word side quest as well. I mean, the three of us, we have a group chat, and it's just, we always talk about our side quests, and when we're together, all about us and our partners, they know that the three of us will just go, oh yeah, they're on a side quest.
Yep.
And they'll just follow us. Like,
yeah,
where are they off to? What are they doing now? Even in conversation. But it's, yeah, stimulates your mind.
It does. It's like
way,
four side quests, and then like sort of mid one quest, you're like, oh yeah, so that's right. And that's what,
yeah,
like circles back to the original thing, and then you carry on that for a while, eh? But you've,
yeah,
been off it for like so long, and then you're like, then sometimes I'll just stop my sentence like, why was I talking about this again?
Yeah.
And then I'll be like, oh, because of this. Oh, yeah.
100%.
You can probably tell that Jenny and I are really bonding. And I think Ants and my partner Knox would find things in common too with having neurodivergent partners. They embrace us and our quirks.
Yeah, the pressure does come on in relationships. You're busy. You're like giving everything to the kids, you know, and to the farm, that's because that's like a baby, you know, like, well, it's not a baby, but you know what I mean. Like, the farm, when it is your job, is never ending, you know. Like, I liken it to like when I was in the police or other jobs I've had, that you can just walk out that door. I mean, sometimes, obviously, like in some jobs, in lots of jobs, you'll leave home and work or a certain scenario or some paperwork or whatever it is in your own job and people's own jobs, it'll play in their heads. But maybe sometimes you can get away with it, but the farm, you look out the kitchen window and you can see how short the grass is, or that the sheep need moving, or the dogs need feed, you know, like, you're never off. And I read or I heard somewhere that the farm will take all of your time and all of your money if you give it. Like, it is just a bottomless pit. It will just take, it could never have enough of your time and your money. You could give it all your time and your money, it would still never be enough, a farm. So it's just finding that balance of, prioritising each other. And, yeah, I think we just work because we are a little bit opposites, and humour works for us. And, like, you know, our kids bond us together as well. I remember a long time ago my dad said to me, when you have kids, you'll change your perspective. And I said, on what? And he said, everything. And he was so true. But I think it's just happened organically for us to be like this. I think one was, you know, Nina taught us so much about ourselves and about others and empathy and just figuring things out. And then you have your own kids, and then that brings about, well, sorry, you have more kids, but, you know, kids that we're able to have with us. And then that brings another set of responsibility and worries and, you know, how do I fit into the world and what do I want to role model to them? But also not getting it right. Like, I'm still learning and I still make huge mistakes and I'm definitely not perfect and I mucked up in so many things and I still do.
And really, what parent ever does get it right? Spending the day with Jenny, Ants and the kids is the best kind of chaos, and as an ADHDer myself, I felt as though we could talk and talk and talk. And we have been on a journey with Jenny. From powder room hookups to policing, from beauty school to running the family farm, and of course, her devastating journey with grief. Ending the day line dancing with her and some of the local wahine feels like the perfect way to shake out the day with some boots and boogieing.
You know, people will see you from the outside and they see you thriving and think that you're so happy, but then also you have this like pain of this child that you never got to know in the ways that you would have imagined. But eventually you have to be like, find the strength to know that it's okay to smile and laugh and enjoy life and not always feel sad, and that actually your loved ones would want that for you. And a friend said to me, you know, like, live the life that you would have lived with Nina, like, you're living the life for her and your family living it for her. And that also really stuck with me. Like, I wouldn't want my friend stuck in grief or my family if I was gone, you know. I'd want them like thriving too. So, you know, I got to a point, well, I'm almost at a point, you know, like, I honestly thought that I would never be able to feel joy again. And like, it is a bit of a catch, because of the times when you feel the most happy is when you look around and you want your family, your friends with you. So that's immediately then sometimes you'll feel sad, because when you feel the most joy is when you want to share that. And then that's when you think of like your babies or the people that you love that aren't there. But again, it comes down to self-preservation. I'm just like learning that I just, you know, what is a life where you can't experience that joy? And so you just have to try your best to do that, and know that that's okay. It doesn't mean you don't love them, it doesn't mean you don't forget them, but also it doesn't even matter if other people thinking that you are forgotten them and that you are enjoying life, because it's not about others, it's about, you know, that you have that strong connection with your child, that it will never be gone, and you can still live this life and you can still find happiness. And I just really would like other mothers or people that have gone through grief that it truly is possible. And it's also, it's ever changing, right? You know, like, some days you're like sweet as for ages, and then all of a sudden it hits you hard like the first day. And you know, but we know with grief that those times can, you know, they generally are, you know, I used to hate it when people say time heals, because it used to be so raw, but it really does feel like it does, like time just does help. And also you have to, like, also having a strong mind, you have to stop letting your body and your mind relive it. And I guess each of us has our own journey to find what helps us, and everyone is different, and you just have to find what works for you.
Thanks for listening to Far From Town, a podcast series from the team at RNZ and Shepherdess. If you enjoyed this episode, make sure you're following the series in your favourite podcast app to hear more stories of women living at the end of windy gravel roads and up remote valleys across Aotearoa. A heartfelt thank you to Jenny Sanford and her whānau, who welcomed us in, shared so openly and gave so generously of their time. It was a privilege to sit at your table and hear your story. I'm your host, Āpej Tanato Rangikura. He uri no Ngāti Raukawa, Ngāti Rangi, Ngāpuhi me Ngāti Rārua. Presenter, writer and producer for the series. Francine Bould captured photos and video along the way. You can see these on the webpage for this series. Felicity Connell is our researcher and production assistant, and Christy McGregor is the series producer. The series was engineered by the RNZ operations team. Justin Gregory is the executive producer for the series, and Brianna Juratich-Gregg is the production coordinator. Thanks to Janina Schwanaker for all the great advice and guidance on the series. Tim Watkin is the executive editor, audio. You can find more of RNZ's great podcasts on the RNZ website, rnz.co.nz/podcasts. Have a listen.